Welcome to the Practical Neurology Podcast, the essential guide for neurologists, and welcome to today's discussion of two of the large choice of excellent case reports selected from the latest edition of Practical Neurology. I'm Martin Turner, I'm a neurologist at the John Radcliffe Hospital in Oxford, and I'll be guiding the conversation with our two correspondents, Ruth and Sinew. So I'll let them introduce themselves. Ruth.
Hi, I'm Ruth Wood. I'm a neurology trainee currently on maternity leave.
Hi, I'm Sinew Tai, a neurology specialty registrar over in Oxford.
Great. Well, it's great to see you both again and have a chance to talk about two more cases. Before we present those, just a reminder to listeners that there are two podcasts linked to the latest edition of the journal. They're already available. The Editor's Highlights discussion with Phil Smith and Geraint Fuller, and the Editor's Choice paper interview, which is conducted, as always, by our very own Amy Ross Russell. So please subscribe on your favourite platform to get notified every time we publish a new podcast. So let's go to the first case today. I think, Sinew, you're going to kick off for us. Tell us how this case presented.
So the article describes a 62-year-old man with a background of high cholesterol who made his way to neurology via the ophthalmology team. And it starts off with a history about a left eye ptosis, for which this man had for a couple of years. And he was arranged to have a ptosis repair by the oculoplastics team. So presumably they felt that this was some form of aponeurotic dehiscence or age-related problem. However, at the time of his ptosis repair, he was noted to have a possible Horner syndrome with abnormal sweating on the same side of the face. And so listeners can have a look at figure one, which shows a constricted pupil as well as the ptosis on one side. Now, as a result, he was referred to neurology and he was seen in the autonomic clinic. And I have to say, this is very much the domain of Queen Square, our national hospital for neurology and neurosurgery, because there can't be that many places where one makes it straight to the autonomic clinic here in the UK.
That's absolutely right. Yes, a triumph of quaternary UK neurology there. So, Ruth, I mean, when you see someone or you get called down to see someone, it's often in ED, isn't it, with a Horner's. What are your sort of thought processes just on that sort of type of referral? I mean, this is clearly a little bit different. They've changed their mind that it's not a routine ptosis repair. He's actually got a Horner's. But if you were referred someone with a Horner's, how do you break that down in your mind? What are the sort of common reasons that you're thinking about?
I'd probably think about it in an anatomical framework. So thinking about whether it's the first, second or third order fibres that have been affected. So I'd think about things affecting central fibres, like strokes, tumours, demyelination. Then there'd also be things affecting the preganglionic fibres. So I think the classic one being something like a Pancoast tumour, for example, malignancy, cervical rib, things like that. And then finally, I'd think about things affecting the postganglionic fibres. So it might be something like an internal carotid artery aneurysm or dissection or a cavernous sinus thrombosis. And I suppose those last two are things you really don't want to miss. So you'd also be thinking about the time course and the kind of features that accompanied the Horner syndrome in the presentation.
Yeah, certainly the ones I've seen in that setting have actually, I think all of them have been carotid dissections and often with a little sort of characteristic delay of several days, sometimes up to a week, really, before they present. And then you have to sort of really dig in the history for what the trauma was. I once saw it by a bilateral carotid dissection with bilateral Horner's from someone who was on chemotherapy for testicular cancer through vomiting, sort of holding onto the loo, violently vomiting and dissected both carotid arteries. So, yeah, they're definitely the thought processes, aren't there? And the Pancoast tumour, of course, it's very rare, isn't it? Is it something either of you have seen?
No, I haven't seen one myself.
Yeah, we're always told about that, aren't we? I always think as well of the subclavian artery central line. That's another potential cause. And that's still done for some procedures. So it's always worth just thinking about that one as well. So this man was transferred as an emergency to the autonomic clinic of Queen Square. And what did they do for him there, Sinew?
Thanks. So just a bit more on the history. He clarified that he had the ptosis for 5 years and he had this reduced sweating down the left side of his body, but he also had excess sweating, so hyperhidrosis, on the left side of his face and neck. And this was provoked by eating. So this is quite interesting. And together with that, he had a 4-year history of a paroxysmal cough, which is part of the title of this article. And so in terms of further investigations, I think this was curated for the article because they first actually start off by saying that his blood test showed an elevated serum angiotensin converting enzyme, so ACE level, with other blood tests being normal. And they go on to describe several other investigations, including nerve conduction studies, which showed reduced amplitude of the sympathetic skin response on the left arm compared to the right. And this was consistent with a partial lesion to the sympathetic outflow of the left arm. Cardiovascular autonomic testing was normal, and Valsalva head-up tilt was unremarkable. 12-lead ECG did show a right bundle branch block, and so a cardiac MR was obtained, and this showed evidence of subepicardial sarcoid. This was with a normal PET scan.
Okay, so I suppose in the sort of more typical situation, we would have picked up on the paroxysmal cough, hadn't sought medical attention for that. So possibly before the CT scan of the chest that we're told about would have had a chest X-ray. We're told the CT showed mediastinal and hilar lymphadenopathy. So we're already into the sarcoid territory there, aren't we? So I think we would have got to that. And the angiotensin converting enzyme, you know, very insensitive, as we know, not wholly specific. Do either of you know why the ACE is raised in sarcoidosis?
I've got a vague recollection of something about type 2 pneumocytes.
Very good. Yeah, well, that's always been my belief when I kind of looked it up. So it might not be solely those, but yeah, type 2 pneumocytes secrete ACE, I think. And that's what we're detecting, certainly in pulmonary involvement. It does get raised in the CSF, though, so there might be more to it, but it could be just simply diffusion across. But certainly there's a contribution from a cell that we might not have thought of. So the CT scan shows the lymphadenopathy, and then I guess it probably would have had, probably would have been an ECG, and that shows bundle branch block, and we know that that can be a feature. But right bundle branch block, of course, this age group might not necessarily be sarcoid specific. And then this kind of unusual finding on a cardiac MRI, which is a little bit more routine now, this subepicardial change, which I guess is something that the radiologists felt they could call as suggestive of sarcoidosis. So at this stage, it seems pretty clear cut. What did they go on to do next, Sinew?
So they did some lung function tests, which were normal, but what they did was an endobronchial ultrasound biopsy of the mediastinal lymph nodes, and this identified non-caseating granulomas, thus confirming sarcoid of the lymph nodes.
Yeah, so that's a very clear cut, isn't it? And that's always what we want, so we know what we're treating, and it's not open-ended. So we've got tissue and a solid diagnosis. Yeah, so what happened next, Sinew?
So in addition to the biopsy, he had an MRI head and neck, which didn't show any carotid artery lesions, but rather showed two possible infiltrative lesions in the skull vertex and the left carotid canal. And so putting this together with the presence of abnormal deposits in the brain, myocardium, sacrum, along with the non-caseating granulomas, this led to a diagnosis of probable neurosarcoid.
They do describe it, don't they, as neurosarcoidosis. Do you think, if we took the Horners away, do you think it's really neurosarcoidosis? It's skull vertex, carotid canal, lungs, heart. I don't think there's any evidence of brain parenchymal or even meningeal involvement, is there?
Yeah, that's true. I suppose perhaps in reference to more of a neurological presentation in this case.
So tell us a bit more about the progress and then in relation to the Horners.
Yeah, so this patient was started on hydroxychloroquine and then prednisolone 60 milligrams, so a high dose. And we are then given this interesting progression where his symptoms showed marked improvement, including the hyperhidrosis, flushing, and his chronic cough, even on weaning the steroids at 6 months. However, unfortunately, at 12 months, a scan showed recurrence of the skull base lesions, and his cough returned when his prednisolone dose went below 4 milligrams a day, for which he found very disabling. This post-gustatory hyperhidrosis also worsened, and interestingly, his serum ACE level increased with the serum recurrence. As you said, I think ACE is a sort of moderate to poor specificity and even worse sensitivity, but this was interesting because it suggests that could be a useful monitoring disease activity marker if raised at the onset.
Yeah, I can't recall definitely, but I think that actually may well be something that is done when it's raised. I think it has, like many of these sort of markers, their diagnostic value, like some of the tumour markers, is very poor in relation to actually their monitoring value. So I think you may well be right there. So Ruth, I mean, this gustatory sweating is a bit strange, isn't it? Remind us about the more common situation of Frey's syndrome, where we see that.
Yeah, it is unusual because I think in this case we'd have expected we'd expected anhidrosis ipsilaterally to the pupil that was affected. And it's also a bit odd that it's triggered by eating as well. And the authors propose three potential explanations for this. The first of which, that this is a situation a bit like Frey's syndrome, which is something that occurs after parotid surgery, where parasympathetic neurons can aberrantly innervate sweat glands. And there can be this paroxysmal response. We know that sarcoid can involve the parotid gland too in Heerfort syndrome. So they propose that as a potential explanation.
Yeah, that seems, I think that does seem quite plausible, doesn't it? That there was perhaps some subclinical parotid involvement. But yeah, I was just looking to see whether we might see that on figure two in the coronal view, but I don't think we're quite in the right spot for that. But what are the other sort of thoughts on mechanism?
Their second suggestion was there might be some sort of compensatory mechanism reflecting downstream damage to more distal postganglionic fibres. And there might have been a sort of compensatory upregulation of fibres that branch off earlier. And those fibres are the ones that carry the pseudomotor and vasomotor supply and run along with the external carotid artery. I couldn't, to be honest, completely get my head around that explanation. I found that not so intuitive. And then the last potential explanation, that perhaps there were microscopic sarcoid lesions, presumably on the contralateral side, affecting those vasomotor and pseudomotor fibres only, causing something called Harlequin syndrome.
Yeah. So overall in this case, Ruth, what did you take away as a sort of learning point from the presentation?
I think just it's quite a basic point, really, but just remembering about sarcoid being a multi-system disorder, really, and the importance of looking everywhere, not just within the nervous system itself, to make the diagnosis.
And how about you, Sinew?
I think that's right. I mean, we say sarcoid is the great mimicker, but actually wasn't on my radar when it came to a presentation like this until it was explained. I suppose another interesting thing was the cough. Should I just mention a few things about the cough?
Yes, let's talk about that, because there are some interesting things postulated in the article about the cough that go beyond just pulmonary sarcoid. So, yeah, talk us through that.
Yeah, the cough was really interesting for me, because cough is apparently very common in people with sarcoidosis. About a third to half of patients from various case studies. It's very disabling, but also very steroid responsive. And the exact cause is quite unclear, because it's often linked to pulmonary disease. But if you do objective lung imaging and lung function tests, the cough isn't really associated to severe pulmonary disease. And so the authors discuss a proposed mechanism of autonomic dysfunction leading to chronic cough. So you could have damage of thinly myelinated afferent fibers in the lung and trachea, which could lead to denervation hypersensitivity in the nucleus solitarius within the medulla. So this idea of chronic cough being linked to dysautonomic function. And it really made me think of a patient that I saw fairly recently in clinic who I thought had a canvas syndrome. So that's cerebellar ataxia with neuropathy and vestibular irreflexia syndrome. And this gentleman, he presented with key features, which are in the name, but he also had a dry paroxysmal cough, which is quite characteristic of the disease. And I remember because he kept coughing when I tried to examine him and he looked quite sheepish about it, couldn't stop himself. And when I did a bit of digging, there was actually quite a lot of dysautonomia in canvas. So this could be a mechanism for the cough as well, which we don't really know why these individuals have the cough. So that was quite striking.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point. I had someone recently with the chronic cough only sort of came to light halfway through the consultation, and I started thinking about the canvas syndrome. I mean, we obviously have to recognise in primary care, chronic cough is, you know, every other patient. But, you know, it's interesting to start to think about how we might guide GPs really to sort of have a different set of questions that they might ask at different age groups, really, and to broaden it a little more from just sort of reflux and those kind of mechanisms into or primary lung, and to think about possible neurological components. Yeah, I think the other thing for me was just a reminder with Horner's to sort of think about the full spectrum of what might be causing it, to try and, if you can, to get an MRI scan of the brain. If you haven't found something on a chest X-ray, if it's very clear cut, obviously we do think about the carotid. But yeah, I think things can certainly hide. And, you know, I think it's sufficiently, it yields a diagnosis typically of Horner's. I'd be interested to know if large series have been done, of how many of them are completely idiopathic. But my sense is it's one of those signs that often, more often than not, does have a very clear cause. And that's why we're taught it, we remember it, and it's a good reminder. Great. Well, thanks so much for going through that complex case. Lots to think about. Let's move on to the second one. So, Ruth, tell us how, well, we've got two cases within this one, haven't we? But tell us how they presented, please.
Yeah, so this is a two-for-one. Two cases from the Institute of Neurological Sciences in Glasgow from Catriona Gribbins and colleagues. And the first case is that of a 70-year-old man who presented with abnormal facial movements. He was previously well and took no regular medications. And in the weeks before he presented, family members had noticed abnormal movements affecting his limbs and his mouth. His speech had become slurred, he was having some swallowing difficulties, and he also reported some weight loss over the preceding 2 years.
Okay, well, that's a really unusual history, isn't it? So, Sunya, you've got someone in their 70s. We're sort of told by the family that the movement disorder might be a question of over weeks, including speech and also then swallowing, but then weight loss over 2 years, so slightly longer for that. I mean, what are your broad thoughts when you got given a history like that over the telephone? What would you be thinking about? What sort of conditions?
I think I'd really try to characterize the movement disorder here. Certainly sounds like a hyperkinetic movement disorder, and options could be some form of chorea, which I think they allude to a little bit more in the introduction, as well as other issues such as tremor and things like that. So if we were to go down the chorea route, we have this 70-year-old gentleman who presents with this fairly recent onset chorea over several weeks affecting all his limbs, as well as these orofacial movements with dysarthria and possibly some dysphagia. So I guess sort of from basic principles, I push hard to see if there's any clues as to whether this had been going on sort of early in life, but it does appear to be quite late onset. With progressive chorea, I usually first think of genetic versus acquired causes. The main genetic cause would be Huntington's disease, which is a well-known autosomal dominant condition. And it can present later in life. So it's worth keeping our differentials, and a family history would be useful, but it could also be a de novo mutation. But I think in keeping with the very brief history, I'd also look into other more acquired causes at this point. So drug induce would be
Drugs definitely for any sort of orofacial kind of dyskinesia, if it wasn't true chorea. The weight loss, of course, might be relevant to a misdiagnosis of Huntington's. So I think that's we shouldn't ignore that. If we were thinking the weight loss was to do with some malignancy, are there paraneoplastic forms of movement disorder like this?
Yeah, so there are a few paraneoplastic syndromes, things like CRMP5, ANNA1, in association with small cell lung cancer, can present with chorea.
Okay, so how would you sort of take this further? What sort of basic first-line investigation should you be thinking about?
Yeah, so I guess on the same line of other acquired causes, such as infection, sort of vascular events, I'd start with some blood tests, look at full blood count, renal function, metabolic profile, look for signs of infection, including HIV, syphilis, any autoimmune processes such as ANA. I'd probably send off celiac antibodies, paraneoplastic antibodies. I probably wouldn't do copper at this age, I think. And I get some brain imaging and some body imaging as well in view of the weight loss.
Yeah. Now here they go straight to the particular sort of cause and learning point that they're presenting. So Ruth, just talk us through a little bit about what they found as the cause.
Looping back to the examination quickly, they confirmed that there were choreiform movements, as Zinyu correctly deduced, particularly affecting the arms, but there were some orofacial movements as well and some dysarthria. And they didn't find any other signs on examination, so no upper motor neuron signs, frontal release signs or cerebellar signs or anything to suggest an HD phenocopy syndrome, Huntington's disease phenocopy syndrome. They did do some investigations, so the routine blood tests that they did, they describe as being normal. The hemoglobin was 171 grams per litre within the normal range, and the hematocrit was 0.54, which is just at the upper end of normal. And the plasma glucose was normal as well.
We're not told, I don't think, that the patient wasn't a smoker or was a smoker. But just a reminder that that's important. You know, here the hemoglobin is normal and the hematocrit just at the top end, but obviously it can be high in smokers, but we'll assume it's a non-smoker, but they were normal anyway. What did the rest of the investigation show?
They did an MRI scan of the brain, which showed no significant abnormalities. There were some posterior periventricular changes in keeping with vascular disease, and they comment that the chordate looked normal bilaterally. They did imaging of the thorax, abdomen and pelvis, and they found a splenic lesion, which they were initially concerned about, but then a subsequent MRI and PET scan suggested this was a hemangioma and not relevant to the overall presentation. And they did do some more in-depth blood tests to look for acquired causes of chorea, including paraneoplastic antibodies, and those were all normal too, as were genetics for Huntington's disease. And finally, a CSF was normal.
So in this sort of setting, Sinew, all the tests are normal. The patient has got the movement disorder. What would you do at that stage? Would you offer them some treatment? Would you just sort of say, we'll see how it goes? How would you handle that?
It's a great question. I think hard and fast of any other causes that might be missing. I consider sending off a genetics test. I don't believe, was that done at this point, Ruth?
They say they did Huntington's disease genetics, okay. But we don't kind of get an idea if they did a wider panel of investigations.
Yeah, and so I probably would try to offer some symptomatic relief, although in my limited experience, symptomatic treatment for chorea is very poor, or rather patients don't respond very well to that. I'd also think of seeing whether there is a clear progression to his symptoms as well, which would make me think of maybe repeating some of the investigations, especially if I suspect a paraneoplastic process.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, clearly it depends how much it's bothering the patient, and you know, time is an investigation, and we shouldn't be afraid to sort of see how things go. I would, in a previous experience of a case, I would do antiphospholipid antibodies. That can definitely be a cause. And there's some vascular changes, I think, on a little bit of vascular disease on the MRI scan. But they went on to do a particular test, didn't they, Ruth? What was that?
Yes, so I think they got a bit of a clue because they repeated the full blood count and found that the hematocrit had actually increased during his admission and was now above the upper limit of normal. So they did genetic testing for polycythemia vera and they identified a JAK2 mutation.
Yeah, and just tell us about the Janus kinase 2 gene and how that links in.
Yes, so I think actually it was interesting. I found that it was initially named Jack because it was just another kinase. And then they mutated the name to be Janus kinase 2, which they felt was a bit more highbrow.
That's brilliant. That's the sort of trivia that, that we're proud to present on this podcast. Thanks for that one, Ruth. That's great.
You're welcome. Nice. So, yes, it's an intracellular non-receptor tyrosine kinase, and it's involved in the production of cells in the myeloid line. And the mutation is an acquired somatic mutation, which makes it active. And overactivation, this gain of function mutation, results in an increased production of red blood cells and also some of the other cells in the same lineage. So you can also get increased platelets as well.
I mean, if you find JAK2, or rather, yeah, if you screen for it in people with raised hematocrit, so I guess biochemical polycythemia, what proportion of cases are going to be positive for that?
I don't know the answer to that, but I do know that of the people that do have polycythemia vera, 96 to 98% will have this specific V617F mutation in JAK2. And if they don't have that in exon 12, they're very likely to have a rarer mutation in exon 14. So it's worth screening for that too. But I don't know the incidence of secondary polycythemia, so I'm not sure what proportion of all polycythemic people will have that mutation.
Okay, but you're right, it's definitely become very much more mainstream now, hasn't it? So they found that. They diagnosed polycythemia vera and started the appropriate treatment. Just remind us what that is.
They give everybody aspirin, low-dose aspirin, and then they aim to reduce the hematocrit, firstly by venesection, and then if that doesn't work, they can add in a cytotoxic agent, a cytoreductive therapy like hydroxycarbamide.
Okay. And then talk us through the second case. How did that one present?
So this was a woman in her 90s who presented with 6 weeks of abnormal movements affecting her right arm and leg. And these then progressed to affect all four limbs over the next 4 weeks. And she didn't have any abnormal movements of her face or her tongue, and her speech and swallow weren't affected. She had more comorbidities. She had ischemic heart disease, arthritis, aortic stenosis, and type 2 diabetes. And she'd already been diagnosed with polycythemia vera 1 year before. And she was taking hydroxycarbamide for this. And when she was examined, she also had chorea, mainly affecting her limbs rather than her face, but everything else was unremarkable. And interestingly, her hemoglobin and hematocrit were also both within the normal range. So her hematocrit was 0.49, which is well within the normal range, but above the target for people with polycythemia vera. And her MRI scan showed some changes, small vessel disease, but nothing else significant. The authors concluded that her chorea was secondary to her polycythemia vera and perhaps her raised hematocrit.
Yeah, and then talk us through really what we think the mechanism is for chorea in this sort of setting, because I certainly recall a case of, I remember being phoned by a renal registrar about a patient who, every time they went into dialysis, they developed a unilateral chorea. And we were sort of musing on whether it might be a sort of low flow problem that was happening during dialysis, and that seemed to be very likely. Is that the feeling that when there's a sort of, I guess, hypercoagulable state, because thrombocythemia is another cause, isn't it? And I've certainly seen chorea with isolated thrombocythemia as well. Is it a low flow thing? What are the other options?
I think there are two main theories. The first being that, so there's a hyperviscosity state and that results in some hypoperfusion to the basal ganglia, for example. And that might cause an upregulation and sensitization of dopamine receptors, for example. And I think in support of that, I suppose we know the basal ganglia are quite vulnerable to things like anoxic injury, and they have a high metabolic activity. And there are case reports of people with secondary polycythemia also having chorea as well. So there is a story of hyperviscosity leading to chorea. But then not everybody with high plasma viscosity gets chorea. And the hematocrit isn't always that high, as we see with these cases, initially within the normal range. And although some patients do respond to things like venesection, other people don't, and they still, their chorea may persist even if their polycythemia has been treated. So there's some kind of pros and cons to that theory. I think the other main thought is that there might be a direct involvement or effect of the JAK2 mutation itself. So they've done some work in mice models which suggests that when you inhibit JAK2, that's neuroprotective. And given that it's active in these people, perhaps there's some pro-inflammatory state going on, which is causing some dysfunctional signaling. And that might be an explanation of why people with essential thrombocythemia who also have a JAK2 mutation have chorea. And I think some people do develop chorea before detectable hematological changes as well. So that could make sense. But then it doesn't explain why reducing the hematocrit does work in some people. And there was an interesting case report where somebody with polycythemia vera started on iron supplementation and their polycythemia worsened and then they developed chorea. So I think the jury's out on which of those two mechanisms it is, really.
Yeah, that is a difficult set of evidence to square, actually. Sinyi, what do you take away from these two cases? How's it going to change your practice?
Yeah, so what I thought was very important is the fact that someone can be polycythemic or have polycythemia ribavera to a point of being symptomatic with chorea with a normal hemoglobin and a normal hematocrit. And so the question then is, should we screen people for the JAK2 mutation even with the presentation of this sort of late onset chorea?
Yeah, I mean, well, let me ask you that. So, you know, next time we see someone with chorea, I mean, I think this seems to tell us that if the hematocrit's normal, we should still send off the JAK2. And presumably we get that result quite quickly and probably more quickly than we would a Huntington's screen.
Yeah, I think that's right. Probably has changed my practice for that.
Yeah. Ruth, did you have any other final thoughts on that?
It's a bit niche, but this case made me think quite a lot about the differences of biological sex in medicine, because I think even though men are more likely to get polycythemia vera, actually there was a case series of people getting chorea who had polycythemia vera, and actually it's more common in women by a factor of 4. So that was interesting. And then in my reading, I also came across the fact that I think in women with polycythemia, we should probably be aiming for a lower hematocrit than we do for men. So I guess I was just thinking a lot about how we treat men and women and whether we use different kind of lenses and probabilities when we think about these cases.
Yeah, absolutely. No, really good point. Well, thanks, Ruth, for that. It was another really interesting couple of cases and some really good learning points. So, yeah, lots to think about there and some practice changing as well. So these are just two cases among the great content in the latest issue. If you're one of our listeners, do leave feedback. If you think there's ways we might improve this podcast, if you've got the chance, then listen to one of the other podcasts on this or other issues. They're available on Spotify, Apple, wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening, and we look forward to another couple of cases in the next issue. And see you then.